Thank you for inviting me, and I think I have a fair amount to cover, so, but please feel free to interrupt me if you have any questions, just raise your hand, because we may get lost by the time you reach the end of the talk. So don't hesitate to interrupt. What I'm going to do is try to cover these major areas in prostate cancer with varying levels of emphasis. So talk about epidemiology, screening, and prevention. And again, as most of you know, there's really not a whole lot of role for screening and prevention, at least these days. It may change in the future. I think risk stratification, at least from a clinical perspective, is extremely important, because you know that helps us decide how to treat somebody when they're diagnosed with prostate cancer. And again, it also really helps us prognosticate as to how long somebody's going to live, at least give them some sort of an idea. Then I'll talk about treatment of early and high-risk disease. And then probably spend quite a bit of time on hormonal therapy, which is really the bread and butter of prostate cancer treatment, you know, both in early-stage disease as well as late-stage disease. So this is something which never really goes away, is always there, is associated with a bunch of side effects. And we really don't have any good way to manage the side effects associated with hormonal therapy, and we can talk some more about that. And then I'll also touch upon more advanced disease, meaning patients who are progressing despite standard hormonal therapy. That's an extremely important area. There's a lot of research going on in the area. Dr. Dean Tang will talk more about that on Thursday, but I'll just kind of warm it up for him for next time. Okay, so here is the slide which shows prostate cancer incidence. And I think the most salient thing here is, so, you know, in the mid-90s, after PSA screening had been in vogue for about 6-7 years, you know, the incidence went up to over 300,000 new patients a year. And then it seemed to level out in the 220,000 to 240,000 range. But in the last couple of years, there's actually been a precipitous fall. So if you see here, this is 2015 actually, and the new cases were about 220,000, and last year there was a huge drop. They were down to 180,000. And I'm sorry I don't have it updated, but I did look it up. For 2017, the projected new cases a year is going to be 162,000. And the main reason for this precipitous drop, especially in the last 2-3 years, so going up down from about 200 plus to now 160,000 has been decreased PSA screening. So in 2012, the USPTF, the Preventive Task Force, came out with recommendations saying that we routinely should not be doing PSA screening. And so since then, there definitely has been a drop, as reflected by the drop in new patients a year. The other thing which is not on here is, if you look at prostate cancer deaths, if you go back to this era, like the early 1990s, it used to be about 40,000 deaths a year. Now, the folks who were proponents of screening, they claim, there are probably multiple reasons, but if you go back here now into the 2000s, the death rate is more like 26 to 27,000 deaths a year from prostate cancer. So it kind of went down from 40,000 to 27,000. And the number for 2017 is actually slightly higher than 2016. The precise number for 2016 was 26,120, and you can look this up, you know, online. And for 2017, it's 26,600. So, you know, maybe the deaths are plateauing, and they may even go up as screening goes down. Okay, but for the folks who have always pushed screening or have advocated screening, you know, they cite this as a reason why we screen. Now, not everybody agrees with that. You know, there are multiple different reasons. But suffice to say that maybe having a stance as no screening at all may not be completely reasonable. Okay. So, sorry, these are the numbers last year, 180,000 total cases, 26,120 deaths. In 2017, once again, the numbers are 160,000 new cases, and I think the deaths are 26,600 something. Okay. The other thing, again, if you look at epidemiology, is, you know, about a third of the patients who are diagnosed are between the age of 55 and 64, and slightly more than a third are between 65 and 74. So the bulk of incident cases are really between 55 and 75, but clearly there are, you know, in other age groups as well. So this is incident new cases, and then if you look at the deaths, they are primarily over the age of 75. So again, it tells you that unless you really have bad luck, most men with prostate cancer just across the board will at least live 10, 12 plus years. Okay. And so the median age at death today is about 80 years. So there's been a lot of, you know, there've been a lot of studies done on chemo prevention, and there are five different alpha reductase inhibitors that were tested. Now, all of them did show benefit, but it's a controversial area because one of the controversies that arose was that perhaps, although it decreases the incidence of cancer almost about 20 or 25%, the cancers that you develop tend to be more aggressive. So the FDA kind of has looked at all these studies, but none of them, you know, it never really led to any approval. And so the recommendations as far as chemo prevention go are really unclear, and they really are none. So at least as of now, it's not something that's pursued a whole lot. From a practical perspective, if people do wind up going on 5-alpha reductase inhibitors, and the one commonest one is finasteride, there's another one called dutasteride, I think the only thing to watch is if somebody is on one of these, what winds up happening is they tend to run falsely low PSAs. So you shouldn't be lulled into complacency by a low PSA in this setting that this person doesn't have cancer. So in other words, it could delay diagnosis. But at least, as of now, there's no specific recommendation for chemo prevention. And then people have looked at vitamin D, they've looked at selenium, and we definitely know that those things don't work. The other thing I want to briefly touch is what do we know about screening? So there have been like three major studies. So there's PLCO, which is actually prostate, lung, colon, and ovary. That was done in the US. And we're only talking about the prostate part of it. Then there's a study from Europe, which is the largest one. And then there's a Swedish study. And all three are summarized here. So if you look at the US study, there were about 150,000 men with prostate cancer. And there was no difference in prostate cancer mortality between the screened arm as opposed to the non-screened arm at 7 years. One of the big problems with this study was where you see this 52% contamination. What that means is in the so-called control arm where no screening was supposed to happen, 52% of the men were actually screened. So that again could account for there being no difference. But also I think 7 years is too short a period if your endpoint is prostate cancer specific mortality. The other one is the European study, and they looked at about 160,000 men, and their median follow-up was 9 years, and what they showed was a 20% reduction in prostate cancer mortality in the screened arm. But the other point is, to see benefit, you had to treat 48 patients to prevent one death. So again, now if you put the hat of a health economist on, suddenly it starts making less sense. And then there's a Swedish study where there was a 44% reduction in prostate cancer mortality, and here you needed to treat 12 patients to prevent one death. So, all these three studies have been analyzed extensively. There are multiple reasons why some show a difference and the others don't. But probably the single biggest difference between the US study and the European studies is we may be dealing with slightly different cancers, or at least in terms of stage. So most cancers in the U.S. are really triggered by finding a high PSA and men having a biopsy. When they have a rectal exam, you don't really feel any abnormality. So by definition, these are T1 cancers, and I'll go into that in a second, what T1 means. Whereas the European cancers were more advanced, and the reason to do a biopsy there was triggered by the fact that they had an abnormal digital rectal exam. So they were T2 and above. So really what that tells you is we may be comparing apples and oranges. So clearly if you intervene in more advanced disease, like in the European cases, you're more likely to pick up benefit. Whereas if you are dealing with very early disease, maybe it'll take longer to find a benefit, or you may not find benefit at all. And I think this is kind of summarized in this conclusions. So first of all, there's low mortality of prostate cancer in the first 10 years. PSA screening probably reduces mortality, but you need longer follow-up. And I think the biggest concern about screening is that there's a large amount of overdiagnosis and overtreatment, at least in the first 10 years. So in other words, you may be treating a lot of people or curing a lot of people who never needed cure. So, but I think the big difference between the big difference between the two continents really is the fact that we pick up cancer much earlier here, and European cancers are probably detected a little later in the game. So, because of all this controversy, all these studies coming out in 2012, the U.S. Preventive Task Force, they came up with recommendations discouraging PSA-based screening. So they didn't say don't do it, but they definitely discouraged it. So I think it's still probably a fair discussion to have with your patient if you're a primary care doc as to what they want to do. You know, there could be other mitigating factors. There may be a family history, especially when somebody's young and they have a family history, probably they ought to be screened. And by family history, I mean not only prostate cancer, but there are families where you have prostate, breast, colon, and uterine cancer running the family. So I think it probably needs to be individualized. The other thing that's been brought up is, and again, the Scandinavians are studying that perhaps, you know, we should use certain, I guess, normograms to decide who would be screened. And then maybe not to do screening every year, but maybe do it every 3 to 4 years. But suffice to say, there's really no consensus on that. And at least at this point, the party line is that PSA-based screening is discouraged. The one thing everybody agrees upon is that over the age of 75, probably men should definitely not be screened. Because again, on an average, most men with prostate cancer will live at least 10 years. And so there's nothing sacrosanct about age 75. If you have a 60-year-old with a life expectancy of less than 10 years, I think the same dictum would apply, that it's probably not worth screening. So I think if you ever get a question, I think wherever you see less than 10-year life expectancy, you're very secure saying screening not indicated. So how do we diagnose of prostate cancer? I still think the three most common things really are an abnormal PSA, and again in the U.S., about 80% of the cancers that are detected are triggered by an abnormal PSA, or an abnormal digital rectal exam, or it's discovered incidentally when men undergo a transurethral resection of the prostate for BPH or benign prostatic hypertrophy. So the other important point here is both BPH, that is benign prostatic hypertrophy, as well as prostate cancer are androgen-driven diseases. But they have nothing, they're not related. Having one does not make you more prone to having the other. The only thing they have in common is they happen as men grow older. Okay. So the other important thing at diagnosis is the pathology. And this thing, the Gleason pattern or the Gleason score has been around for the last, 30, 40 years. And if you have to take one metric which predicts how somebody is going to do, this is probably the single most reliable parameter. And so the Gleason pattern goes from 1 through 5. So 1 are very well differentiated tumors, and 5 are very poorly differentiated tumors. And the way a Gleason score is you get that if you look at the primary pattern and the secondary pattern and you add the two up. So on the report, it will say 3 plus 4 or 4 plus 3 or 5 plus 5. So if you see a report just with a single Gleason score, you should wonder about the pathologist. And the reason I bring that up is all our decision making, or the bulk of our decision making, is driven by what the Gleason score is. So it's really important, to make sure that this has been read by somebody who does this for a living. So the other thing we also know is that it's really very hard to tell Gleason 1 and 2. And so most reports will seldom have a Gleason grade of less than 3, a Gleason pattern of less than 3. So if you start seeing scores like in the neuropathology reports, less than a Gleason score of 4, less than a Gleason score of 5, again you should wonder about the pathology and make sure it's reviewed by a GU pathologist. So once again, this is a Gleason pattern. And really what we're looking at is the Gleason score, because different parts of the prostate look differently. So you look at the primary pattern, which is the primary score, and then you look at the secondary pattern, which is the secondary score, and actually the Gleason score is a cumulative of the two. So this is what I just talked about a little earlier, which was, so this is the sagittal section of the prostate. So T1s are tumors that you can't really feel. So when somebody has a digital rectal exam, they don't feel any abnormality. You call it a T2 if you can palpate a nodule. It's a T3 if it's extra, it's outside the prostate involving the seminal vesicles or outside, has gone to the margin. And T4 is involvement of the adjacent organs. And then within T2 and T3, there's A and B depending on the level of involvement. And T4 again, whether A and B depending on whether it's the immediate adjacent organs or it's the pelvic floor. Okay. So once again, when we initially diagnose somebody, the three things that are important are the PSA diagnosis, the Gleason score, and the T stage. And if you look at all prostate nomograms, all of them are based on these three. Now obviously, if somebody has had surgery, you have more attributes that you can add onto the nomogram, but the nuts and bolts of the nomogram are really made of these three things: the T stage, the PSA, and the Gleason score. So based on this, again, now this is not 100% accurate, but it's, at least from a clinical perspective for decision making, it's pretty reasonable. So once you have this information, you should be able to peg somebody into low risk, intermediate risk, or poor risk. And I think this risk stratification is extremely important because it drives all decision making. So really what we mean by poor risk or high risk is that local therapy here alone is not going to help. So this group of men not only needs local therapy to deal with the primary cancer, but they also need systemic therapy to wipe out micrometastatic disease. So low risk is a PSA of less than 10, a Gleason of less than 7, and stage T1C, or maybe even a T2A. So they really have to have all these three criteria. For intermediate risk, you could have any one of these three: a PSA of 10 to 20, a Gleason 7, or a stage T2B. And the poor risk or high risk is a PSA over 20, a Gleason of more than 7, or stage T2C. So T2B is involvement of 75% of the gland, and T2C is bilateral. And the other thing, obviously, when we do a diagnosis is we do a bone scan and a CT scan, just to see if they have any, if there are any distant metastases or not. So if you look at the pattern of spread in prostate cancer, the commonest sites are the regional lymph nodes or lymph nodes, in the para-aortic area or the retroperitoneal area. And the other is obviously the bone. So, if men live long enough with prostate cancer, 95% of them will develop metastases to the bone. So imaging is another thing which is it's kind of up a little bit in the air. But right now, this is what we use. This is what we use, which drives all the decisions. The reason it's gotten confusing is because of PET scans. So the standard PET scan that we use in, oncologic practice is FDG-based PET, where the tracer is glucose. But that's actually not a good scan for prostate, because prostate cancer is not very FDG avid. But there are at least three other scans which have good utility in prostate, but where they stand in decision making is unclear. So the first one is a fluoride-based PET, or F18 PET, which is actually very good to look at bone metastasis. But most of our decision making is dependent on the standard technetium-based bone scan and not the F18 PET. But that's again something which may probably creep into practice with time. The other PET that is approved, which is good both for soft tissue as well as for bone, is a choline-based PET. But the choline label is pretty unstable and has to be synthesized and used fairly quickly. And the only place that is approved or FDA approved to actually do that is as Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, because they synthesize their own label. And then recently, there's another PET, another PET label that has gotten approved. It's based, again, it's a choline-based one. It's called Flucyclovin. And that got approved like about 4 or 5 months ago. And again, if the idea is it's a choline-based PET, and that probably will also wind up coming more in use. But the big problem there is we don't quite know at this point how that will be integrated into clinical decision making. Once you've treated somebody, the main thing really we still use is the PSA for following somebody as to how they're doing, and then the bone scan and the CT scan. So it's not unusual to have people with, with recurrent disease with a PSA of 1 or 2, with negative or negative standard imaging, but a positive F18 PET. And we're not quite sure how best to handle that. The one place it can help is if you were contemplating that somebody should undergo surgery and they have a positive F18 PET, they probably should not have surgery because they have distant disease. But in the other settings, I think it still needs to be worked out how we use that. And then finally, there's one other PET scan which is investigational, and that uses dihydrotestosterone as the label. But that again is a supersensitive PET scan. Again, it's investigational. Not quite sure where it will wind up. So, but once again, the three approved ones are the F18 PET for bones, the choline-based PET, and the flucyclovin-based PET. The other thing for stratifying that people have been using is a 17-gene signature, and this is primarily to separate men with low-risk disease and intermediate-risk disease. So, again, remember when we said low-risk, we said Gleason of less than 7. But there are some men who have Gleason less than 7 who do poorly. And I think that's where it kind of gets more subtle, and that's where further diagnostics is going to be important. Again, most of what we have, 95%+ is adenocarcinoma of the prostate. And really all these comments apply to that. But there is a neuroendocrine variant. There are other variants as well. And I'll go into that in a few, towards the end of the talk. So clearly those rules don't apply here. Okay. So again, now moving back to, treatment choices. So once again, remember, we have at diagnosis, let's just talk about organ-confined disease, meaning the CT scan and bone scan are negative, and you've decided, you've been able to put somebody into the category either for low risk, intermediate risk, or high risk. So if somebody is low risk, it's completely reasonable to do active surveillance, or they could have a prostatectomy, or they could have some form of radiation. There's really no role for hormonal therapy if it's low risk. There's definitely need for this in high risk, and in intermediate risk, it depends on other factors, but most people would probably at least use limited hormonal therapy. So, going back to low risk disease, probably, and again, this was another study which also led to the sentiment against screening. So this is 24,000 men who underwent a radical prostatectomy over a 20-year period at the Cleveland Clinic, at Memorial Sloan Kettering, at Baylor, University of Michigan, and Johns Hopkins. And all their pathologic specimens were reviewed by GU pathologists. Again, I can't emphasize this enough. Since all our decision-making, or most of it is driven by the Gleason score, this is actually extremely, extremely important. And the endpoint here was prostate cancer mortality. And if you look at this, 50% of this cohort was Gleason 6. And their 15-year prostate cancer specific mortality was less than 1%. So clearly there were too many surgeries being done. And we were curing people who didn't need to be cured. And in this cohort, there was only one in about 4,000 men with Gleason 6 who died of prostate cancer. So really what it's telling you is that in Gleason 6, active surveillance is completely a legitimate thing to do. Now 40% of this cohort was Gleason 7, and even their 15-year prostate cancer specific mortality was only 8%. And it accounted for 50% of all cancer deaths. And then now if you come to Gleason 8 and 10, they were only 10% of all cases. And here, the 15-year prostate cancer-specific mortality was 49%. So I think it's based on this that, you know, most Gleason 6 are probably going through active surveillance now. But again, you have to be sure it's a Gleason 6. And that again is, you know, that's where the GU pathologist is vital. Whereas most Gleason 7s through 10 are treated because they account for most of the mortality. That is prostate cancer specific mortality. Okay. But even the Gleason 7 group, the important point is, you know, the majority of men still live 15 plus years. Right? It was only 8% mortality at 15 years. Only 8% of the men died in 15 years. So again, I think the other thing that plays into this is what is the age at diagnosis? And if about 40% of men are being diagnosed over the age of 65, you could still take a pretty conservative approach. So there's somebody with Gleason 7, it may be reasonable to do active surveillance in them. Okay. So here is another important paper, and this is from the group in Canada who have been Larry Klotz, who's a urologist up in Toronto. He's been working on active surveillance for the longest time, and here is their long-term follow-up. And again, first of all, what they show is about 65% of the men, they wind up staying on active surveillance even at 12 years. And if you look at the cancer-specific survival, I mean, it's 95%+. So again, it just tells you that, you know, active surveillance is a very, very valid thing to do in the right person. So either Gleason 6, or if it's a higher Gleason grade, then it's probably dictated by their life expectancy. And again, remember, about 40% of men, or even slightly higher, at the time of diagnosis are 65+. So active surveillance for favorable risk prostate cancer is feasible and is safe in the 15-year time frame. Only 2.8% people develop metastatic disease, and 1.5% died of prostate cancer, and mortality rate is consistent with expected mortality in favorable risk patients managed either with surgery or radiation. That's what they mean by definitive intervention. But there is a cost to active surveillance as well. So when we say active surveillance, what we do is, so these men have their PSAs followed every 3 to 6 months initially, and then maybe at a longer interval, and the trigger for a repeat biopsy or intervention is either the PSA going up or the digital rectal exam becoming abnormal. So there is a lot of anxiety associated with that. There are a lot of additional biopsies. There is a lot of additional imaging. So it's not completely free. Okay. So we talked about low-risk disease. So now I'm going to move on to high-risk disease. So this is Gleason 8 and above. And I think that the main point here is that local therapy alone is not going to cure these men. And not only do they need local therapy, they also need systemic therapy. Okay. So the clinical trial that really puts systemic therapy on the map, this is from the European Radiation Oncology Group. And essentially they took men with high-risk disease, which once again is Gleason 8 and above, a PSA over 20, or clinical T3, T4, meaning extravascular disease. And what they found was that these men, if they had radiation alone, their 10-year survival was about 45%. But if they had radiation therapy along with hormones, there was about a 20% survival advantage. Now, this is only the 8-year data, but this has stood the test of time. And the same holds true, this has been updated even at about 13 to 14 years. So there's roughly a 20% survival advantage to combining systemic therapy with local therapy. But most of these studies have been done in the context of radiation therapy. So this is a study from Europe. There's a similar study done in the US with larger numbers, and again, it's the same results. So how long do we do systemic therapy for? So this trial used 3 years. In the US study, that's been done for 2 years. So right now, you know, the bias is either 2 or 3 years is enough. It's also been tried for shorter periods, like just about 4 to 6 months, and that is definitely not enough. So we know that 6 months is not good enough. We know that 2 or 3 years is good. If there's some intermediate time in between, we don't know. And currently, 18 months is being looked at. And really what I mean here by systemic therapy is hormonal therapy, and we'll get into that in a little bit. Okay. And so clearly, the prolonged duration of hormonal therapy needs to be balanced with the side effects. Okay. So then it's also come up, how about people with intermediate risk disease? So this would be less than Gleason 8, less than PSA of 20, and also some high-risk men who definitely have T1, T2, and not T3 disease. So let's say if you have somebody with a Gleason 8, but a T1, T2, and he's 75, I'm not sure the gentleman needs 3 years of hormones because of all the side effects. So that's why it's been lumped with the intermediate group. And in the intermediate group, they've looked at 6 months of systemic therapy or hormonal therapy or androgen deprivation therapy. So they're all synonymous. And this also, shows about a 6 to 8% survival advantage. So in the setting of intermediate risk disease, again in the right patient, 6 months of hormonal therapy is probably adequate. Okay. So the other thing that's also come up is, in somebody who's had surgery, should they get adjuvant radiation? And there are two studies that showed overall survival benefit. And again, the men who would be candidates here would be either who are node positive or who have T3 or T4 disease. And at this point, I think most people would consider this standard of care. But the problem here is when somebody's had surgery, you know, very often they are incontinent. And if you come in with radiation too early, they could get permanent incontinence. So I think a lot of people like to wait till men have better, you know, sphincter control before doing radiation. So the timing has always been, debatable. Or what the best time to do it has been debatable. By definition, most adjuvant therapy is within 3 to 4 months of the primary therapy. I think most people would do it within 6 months, but I know the bias at Roswell is they like to wait 9 months to a year. So I'm not 100% sure it's truly adjuvant at that time. So again, it's the side effect profile you have to balance before doing radiation after surgery. So chemotherapy is also being tested, and there is no definite benefit to it. Hormonal therapy is I have here no proven benefit, but I think there's a lot of debate. We know that men who are node positive at the time of surgery benefit from androgen deprivation therapy, but it's probably not for all comers. And this is a study which, this is the only study with long-term hormones in the setting of surgery. So in the setting of radiation, there are plenty of studies. So this was again a randomized study, but it only had 98 patients. So this is like the biggest critique. And this is a fairly old study. I think it was designed in the late 80s. It took them 12 years to complete. And they only accrued 98 patients. And this was men who at the time of prostatectomy were node positive on frozen. They either had an orchiectomy or not. Right? So again, orchiectomy is the same as hormonal therapy, but here it was permanent, because they had an orchiectomy, and once again, at about 10 to 12 years, there's a 20% survival benefit. So I think based on the radiation studies, based on the surgical study, I think the feeling is that at least in node-positive men at the time of surgery, at least one should have the discussion and offer them hormone therapy. So how do we define cure after surgery, and how do we define cure after radiation? So if you take the prostate out, if you're cured, your PSA should be less than 0.1. If it is 0.1, it's considered detectable, and if it's 0.2, it's considered a relapse. So a lot of people, even though you're node positive after surgery, if the PSA is undetectable, they actually may not do anything. But they monitor the PSA carefully, and at the first sign of it going up, they think about extra radiation or even hormone therapy. Okay. In the setting of radiation, it's called something called the Phoenix criteria. So these are men who never had their prostates taken out but got radiation therapy as their main modality of treatment. Failure is defined as PSA more than 2. Realistically, most men will kind of drop down to about 0.4, 0.5, 0.6. Then they may actually go up to 1.4, 1.5 about 8 months after radiation. It's thought to be related to a prostatitis, and then drift down again. But because of all this uncertainty, you know, a group of radiation oncologists got together in Phoenix and they came up with the Phoenix criteria, where relapse after radiation is technically defined as a PSA of more than 2. So obviously this is in the setting of completely normal scans. And when I say normal scans, it's bone scan and CT scan. Traditional imaging and not the PET-based imaging. Okay. I think this is the same one which I showed, just with longer time. Again, the 20% survival advantage with hormone therapy. Any questions up to here? Okay. So, you know, this is one way you can view the whole natural history of prostate cancer. Again, as we said, in the majority of men, it's going to be a fairly long journey. You can look at men as being castration sensitive. And when you treat them with hormone therapy, they do become castrate resistant. In either of these settings, they could have PSA-only disease, which we call non-metastatic. So the only thing they have is the PSA going up, the scans up here, and or they could have metastatic. And either of these conditions can either be asymptomatic or symptomatic. So symptoms is definitely a bad way of picking up somebody or using that to diagnose prostate cancer. Right? By the time you get symptoms, I mean, the horse is way, way outside the barn. Okay. So if we now go on to early disease, so initially, you know, either men will get either active surveillance or they will get radiation or they'll get surgery. Despite all that, so really despite radiation or surgery, about a third of men will relapse, so, you know, depending on where you are, maybe even 40%. And when they relapse, the first thing, or the first systemic therapy most of them will see is androgen deprivation therapy. Also, primary hormonal therapy. They'll respond to it, but eventually they'll fail. And once they fail, in the past we only used to have chemotherapy, but now we have a bunch of other drugs which I'll kind of go into in a little bit. And then, in this setting, when somebody is metastatic, castrate resistant, and either asymptomatic or symptomatic, you know, median survival used to be only a year. But with all these new drugs, we're probably more like 4 years now. But again, I think it's a range. One could have very aggressive disease. You know, depending on what the exact molecular abnormality is, the lifespan could be very short. But I think on an average, it's fair to say, you know, when people come in, especially when they are symptomatic, metastatic, castrate resistant, the number we give them is about 3 years. But again, that's the median. It could be less, could be more. And with the newer therapies, you know, we do seem to be making at least small increments in survival. Okay. So to go back to this, you know, men out here before they get androgen deprivation therapy. So these are men who have failed local therapy and their PSA is going up. So something we call castrate sensitive, non-metastatic, asymptomatic, or PSA-only disease. So there is actually a really important paper, and this is from Charlie Pound, it's from Johns Hopkins. And this is the natural history of men with a rising PSA. Till the time they developed metastasis, till they developed symptomatic metastasis. Now, clearly, we would never do this study again. So this is a group of about 2,000 men. Now, 15% or 304 relapsed, and they didn't get any treatment till they had not only were the bone scan positive, but they were also symptomatic. And what they found was, on an average, once the PSA goes up, it takes 8 years for the bone scan to become positive, and another 5 years to die. And they probably got treated somewhere here. So the natural history of, you know, untreated PSA-only disease is fairly long. Now, the only problem with this is, I mean, this is clearly a group of highly selected men. Remember, they had 2,000 men and only 15% or 304 relapsed. And then when you go back and look at the fine print in the paper, only 8% of these men had Gleason 8 and above disease. So 92% had Gleason 7 or less. So clearly this was primarily low risk, or maybe a few intermediate risk men. And this has always been the Hopkins bias. In fact, if you have prostate cancer and if you have Gleason 8 and above, nobody at Hopkins is going to take your prostate out. And again, they've done that because they feel that if it's Gleason 8 and above, you're not going to be able to cure them with surgery alone. And again, Johns Hopkins also has the bias. They've always felt that early hormone therapy doesn't prolong survival. Now, not everybody agrees with that. In fact, most people don't. But for good or for bad, that's been their bias, and that's why a lot of those studies have come out from there. But what we do know about this group is, and again, it's a paper from that same group of patients which was updated in 2005, you can actually sub-stratify how people are going to do based on their PSA doubling time. So there are two important caveats here. To really pass a commentary on the PSA doubling time, you have to deal with real numbers. So 0.1 to 0.6 is not six times, but 1 to 2 is doubling, and 3 to 6 is doubling, and so on and so forth. So most of these doubling times have been calculated once somebody had a whole number. And based on that, if in the men who had a PSA doubling time of more than 15 months, they had a very indolent course. But men with a PSA doubling time of less than 3 months had a much more aggressive course. So the cutoff that we've used is more like about 9 months. So if you see, there's a big drop-off in men who have a PSA doubling time between 3 and 9 months. You know, their outcome is much worse. Whereas 9 to 14 or more than 15 months is different. So the reason this is important is, so when you start treating men on clinical trials, and if you just did it for PSA-only disease, I mean, if you pick men in this cohort, you're going to, you know, your drug is going to do great. So that's why it's important to stratify who you're going to treat with any particular intervention based on their PSA doubling time. So we tend to observe most men if their scans are clear and their PSA doubling time is more than 9 months. But if it's less than 9 months, we tend to either put them on trial or intervene. Now again, this is where PET scans are going to create a confusion. You know, you could have somebody with a PSA doubling, let's say the PSA is 7, let's say the doubling time is 11 or 12 months, bone scans negative, CT scans negative, and if you do an F18 PET, that lights up. I mean, what would you do? So I guess nobody knows the answer to that. So that's where having a, you know, that's where imaging may outstrip therapy. Okay. So, you know, we've mainly been talking about early disease, either high risk or low risk. The other thing is probably oligometastatic disease. So meaning, you have the primary prostate cancer, but you also have a couple of spots elsewhere, especially in the F18 PET era, that may become a bigger problem. So I think the dictum has always been that if you have metastatic disease or the horse is outside the barn, there's no point in burning the barn down or whipping it out, meaning there's no point doing surgery or radiation. But I think the pendulum may be swinging or shifting, and this was the first paper where they, you know, a phase 3 study, where they showed that in the setting of locally advanced prostate cancer, you know, where in the olden days we would have just done hormone therapy, combining hormones with radiation versus just hormones alone showed a benefit to using both. So I think, and this is probably true of surgery as well, so if somebody's 55 or 56, you know, they have prostate cancer with maybe 2 spots in the bone, what we call oligometastatic disease. I think clearly they need hormones, but probably there's merit in either doing radiation or taking the prostate out. So the survival advantage is not huge, but, you know, it's about 8-9%. And, you know, most of the time in cancer, that's the best we do. I mean, survival advantages with chemotherapy are anywhere 5-9%. The only time you get in the 20s is with hormonal therapy, whether it's prostate cancer or ER-directed therapy in women with ER-positive breast cancer. Okay, so the conclusion this was that the role of radiation therapy is clearly established for high-risk, locally advanced disease, and the evidence is mounting for metastatic patients. Now, when I say metastatic, really we're talking about oligometastatic disease. And there's also evidence for surgery, but there are no randomized controlled trials, unlike radiation, that are available. For whatever reason, at least in prostate cancer, you know, most of the randomized studies are really done by the radiation oncologists. It takes longer and harder for the surgeons to come around to do those. Okay. So, you know, we've been talking about systemic therapy, hormone therapy, androgen deprivation therapy, so let's define that. So it's really any treatment that blocks interaction between androgens and the androgen receptor. Right? So you can do it a bunch of different ways. So you can remove the ligand, so you can do an orchiectomy, which at least will take care of testicular androgens. You can use LHRH agonists, you can use LHRH antagonists, you can use estrogens, and really all of them, what they are primarily doing is blocking the testes. Right? So you're already taking care of testicular androgens. Or you can use combined androgen blockade. So not only are you shutting down androgen production from the testes, but you're also blocking the androgen receptor, which at the end of the day, you know, is the final common pathway for all signals seen by androgen-dependent organs. Or you can use anti-androgen monotherapy. Okay? And so the important thing with this is that all these therapies, I have your existing, but let's call them primary hormonal therapies, they do not adequately suppress either adrenal or intratumoral production of androgens. So that's really been the big, advance in prostate cancer. You know, people would fail an orchiectomy or primary androgen deprivation therapy. Their serum testosterone would be low or castrate, and yet their cancer would get worse. But what we have learned is if you suppress adrenal and, much more importantly, intratumoral androgens, which you can't really measure in the serum, you still can, you know, you still get benefit in treating the cancer. And that's really what castrate-resistant prostate cancer is. All it means is progressive disease, be it PSA or be it worsening imaging studies, despite castrate serum testosterone levels. And most of the serum testosterone, it primarily comes from the testes. And that's really what primary androgen deprivation therapy is blocking the testes. So this is just, the endocrine axis, the hypothalamus, the pituitary, the testes. And again, as you all know, really what the testes responds to is pulsatile LHRH. And that's why LHRH agonists are used. So if you give them continuously, you ablate the testes. And that's what LHRH agonists do. But now we also have LHRH antagonists, which will get the testosterone down much more rapidly. So with the agonist, it takes about 28 days to get castrate testosterone levels. With the antagonist, it's within a day or two. Okay. And really what they do is they ultimately suppress FSH and LH. Okay. So once you have testosterone, doesn't matter where it's coming from, whether it's from the adrenals or the testes, you know, it enters the target organ, and within the cytoplasm, T is converted to DHT, and this is where 5-alpha reductase comes in. Then the DHT goes and binds to the androgen receptor, and then this complex is shuttled to the nucleus by heat shock proteins. So you can really perturb the pathway anywhere. Until very recently, most of the anti-androgens we had were not very potent. And now we have more potent anti-androgens. And so that's been the other advance in prostate cancer. So what are the indications for androgen deprivation therapy? So I'm still talking about primary androgen deprivation therapy. So everybody agrees for newly diagnosed metastatic disease, so there's no debate there. then as adjuvant therapy for node-positive disease discovered at prostatectomy. I think most people agree with that, but maybe about 10% don't. Combined with radiotherapy in patients with intermediate, where it would be for 6 months, and for high risk, where it would be for 2 to 3 years. And then use of androgen deprivation therapy in patients with PSA-only disease is controversial, but we probably, most of us, wind up using it once the PSA doubling time is less than 6 months, you know, based on the initial stuff that I showed you. Okay. So moving on to metastatic prostate cancer. So this kind of, these are just some of the important studies. So there are different cooperative groups in the U.S. Most of these initial work were done by the Southwest Oncology Group. That's why you have this S. And this is probably the most important study, S9346, where based on that they were able to figure out that if you intervene early with metastatic disease, median survival is about 49 months or 4 years. Now remember, this data may conflict slightly with what I showed you earlier, because remember there is CRPC average saying median survival is 1 to 4 years. So, but remember, you know, most of this was in the early 90s, when this, you know, just when the PSA had come out. And all this reflects, you know, this change from 31 to 30, so let's say from 2.5 years to 3 years to 4 years, it really just depends on the time period that we were treating, because therapy was not really different. It was all androgen deprivation therapy or standard hormonal therapy. I think it's just that here we were picking up patients a little more earlier, and that's why the survival is, so you were intervening early, and so the survival is slightly longer. So this is what we call stage migration. The sooner you do things, you know, the sooner you use, so, you know, you do PSA screening, you pick up prostate cancer earlier, you take the prostates out earlier, they fail earlier, hormones are given earlier, meds are earlier. So that's just called stage migration, okay? So it was probably 3 to 4 years. But I think what we have now is probably more real, because these are, you know, from the 1990s. The reason all this becomes important is, you know, the question comes up, are we really changing survival or not with all our treatments? And I think the answer is mixed. I think part of it is stage migration and part of it is a real advance in therapy. But it can be very hard to separate the two. Okay. So the reason this trial is important is, here they compared intermittent versus continuous androgen deprivation therapy. And I think the single most important thing from this was, they were able to prognosticate how somebody was going to do based on the PSA response. So this is after you start androgen deprivation therapy. And if at 8 months, the group that did the best was where the PSA dropped to less than 0.2. Then the intermediate group was where the PSA dropped to less than 4 but didn't go down to less than 0.2. And the third group, the PSA never really dropped below 4. Okay, so this was a more resistant group. And if you look at their median survival, in the group where their PSA didn't drop favorably, and again, it's a favorable here is defined as, or unfavorable here is defined as PSA staying over 4, median survival was only 1 year. In the intermediate group, it was close to 4 years, and in the favorable group, it was 6 years. So I think, again, this is a very useful information to have, especially when you're counseling patients or, you know, you're discussing prognosis. So the advance in the metastatic setting has been, if you combine chemotherapy upfront with androgen deprivation therapy, you get approximately a 15% survival advantage. Okay? And again, if you look at this group, you can stratify them again as the 0.2, between 0.2 and 4 and over 4. So in the over 4s, this was all comers. In this group, with hormones alone, it was 32 months median survival. And when you added chemotherapy, it was 49 months. Whereas in the more favorable group, at least at the time they analyzed the study, median survival had not been reached. So again, these are not all comers, this is just a way of further stratifying patients and being able to prognosticate. Okay. T think I'm going to race to the rest of the shelf. So I think this is probably very important. What are the side effects of androgen deprivation therapy? And you can split them up into the big three, which is loss of libido, erectile dysfunction, and hot flashes. Then what you see, weight gain, gynecomastia, loss of muscle mass, decrease in sex organs, hair changes, then all the metabolic stuff, loss of bone mineral density, anemia, and the so-called metabolic syndrome with hypercholesterolemia, hypertension, diabetes, or cardiovascular disease, and then all the emotional stuff. So I think very often we really don't have the time and we don't talk much about this with patients in the clinic. Neither do men complain a whole lot about all these things. But again, I think if you think about it, most of these men are going to live 15 to 20 years. They're permanently castrated. And actually the side effect burden is huge. And I really don't think as a group or as a community we do a good job of addressing all this. So again, for those of you who are interested in this stuff, I mean, this is a huge, huge growth area. And for whatever reason, most bad things seem to happen after about 9 months. So this is just looking at changes in bone mineral density. So if you just do 1 to 4 doses, it doesn't drop a whole lot. But after about 9 months, there seems to be quite a precipitous drop in bone mineral density. The same is true for cardiovascular problems. The same is true for cognitive changes. So it's just something to be aware of. And that was the whole reason why intermittent therapy was so much in vogue. But I think what the earlier study that I showed you was, what it showed us was that actually continuous therapy is superior to intermittent therapy. Now obviously there are exceptions, right? So somebody has a heart attack, they have out of control diabetes, or they have other metabolic side effects. So you have to weigh therapy with both life expectancy and other comorbidities. Okay, I think I'm going to race through all this. It basically talks about what I told you earlier. I think I want to end with castrate-resistant prostate cancer, and I think I kind of defined this earlier, which is basically progressive disease despite castrate testosterone levels. And just to put this in perspective, I think the most common scale that is used is the nanogram scale. And the normal on that is anywhere from, depending on which lab you have it run at, it can be between 250 and 1,000. And on that, castrate is defined as less than 50, right? So if normal is 250 to 1,000, and if castrate is 50, what is 51 to 249? I guess it's hypogonadism, but not quite castration. And the other point is, we use 50 as a cutoff, but depending on where you are in your journey with CRPC, if you have an extremely sensitive AR, you could actually respond to much lower levels of testosterone. That may be enough to keep the cancer growing. So all I'm saying is there is still room to work with T levels of less than 50. Okay? And then CRPC will develop in all patients who receive androgen deprivation therapy. And in all of them, the AR is still present and functional. So then it really boils down to what are the mechanisms of CRPC. So you can either have increased androgen biosynthesis, or you can have persistent androgen receptor signaling. And there are multiple different mechanisms, and Dean's going to talk more about that. But one of the things that happens is the enzymes that are responsible for converting cholesterol to testosterone, since that's the precursor of most sex steroids, they are 10 to 20 fold upregulated. So although your serum testosterone doesn't go up, at the tumor level there's a lot going on. So clearly there is room both for blocking androgen biosynthesis and blocking the receptor more effectively, or doing a combination of the two. And because of the fact I said that we treat people earlier, most men with CRPC do not yet have radiographic metastasis. And in them, the median survival is clearly could be even more than 5 years. Because the median time to metastasis in these men is 2 to 3 years. And again, PET imaging could change this. And determinants of time to onset of mets and level are the level of PSA and CSF at the same time. So that's what I meant when I said, in the majority of men who have standard garden variety adenocarcinoma of the prostate, P PSA is a very useful parameter to follow. I think you can email me if you have questions on these things. So this was the first vaccine that was approved for prostate cancer. These are two new hormonal agents. So the first is abiraterone, which is an androgen biosynthesis inhibitor, and the other is enzalutamide, which is an AR blocker. This just outlines the steroidogenesis pathway, and this is where, you know, these drugs act. They are 17 hydroxylase and C1720 lyase inhibitors. This is the mechanism of action of enzalutamide, which competes with DHT, which is the, you know, the most potent androgen, to bind to the androgen receptor. It can also prevent translocation of the complex into the nucleus, and it can also block binding of the DHT-AR complex to the binding regions on androgen-dependent genes. So these are just some of the studies that led to the approval. And here it just gives you a quick, snapshot of survival benefit. So here it's about 4 months, another 4 to 5 months, another 3 months, another 3 to 4 months. So I think cumulatively, if you look at it, it doesn't sound like a whole. I mean, singly, if you look at it, it doesn't sound like a whole lot. But remember, it's median survival. So this also takes into account people who haven't responded. And I think the benefit in any given person could be much more or much less. So again, going back to the utility of PSA, in the first trial where chemotherapy was approved, I think the overall survival advantage was about 3.9 months. But then if you sub-stratified patients based on their PSA response, the men who dropped their PSA more than 90%, their median survival was 3 years compared to 18 months in controls. Those who dropped it 50%, it was 50% or more, it was 2 years. And if it was less than 50%, it was only a month and a half. So again, I think the devil's always in the details, but when you do a phase 3 study, you have to analyze everything together. When you do this, when you do the sub-analysis, at the end of the day, they are hypothesis generating but not proof. But it just tells you that individual benefit may be either more or less than what the median benefit is. I mean, that's just something to keep in mind. So if you look at the prostate cancer landscape in 2017, for early disease, it's surgery, radiation, or active surveillance. For PSA-only disease, there is no standard of care. For metastatic hormone-naive, it's hormones plus chemotherapy. If you have low-volume mets, there's no point adding chemotherapy. If you have high-volume mets, there is merit in adding chemotherapy. And if you're castrate-resistant, once again, in PSA-only disease, there is no standard of care. And then, in the metastatic setting, you can either be chemotherapy-naive, or you could be chemotherapy resistant, and essentially most people wind up seeing these different agents in sequence. So this is the vaccine, the syphilisyl T. These are the second line hormonal agents. So this is the AR blocker, this is the androgen biosynthesis inhibitor, this is chemotherapy, this is just supportive care for bones, this is a radionuclide, and this is another chemotherapy. So essentially what we do is we just shuffle these in the castrate-resistant setting, and that's where we've been able to come up with this median survival of about 3 years. I guess the two major milestones in 2015 were actually looking at the molecular phenotype, both of primary tumors, which is this paper, and also of advanced cancer. So the notion here is when you treat a lot, the molecular phenotype of the cancer changes, and Dean's going to talk about this on Thursday. And what I just want to leave you with is, I think what is emerging is that, and again, I've moved to advanced disease or castrate-resistant disease, I still think the targets that are probably going to be important are still the androgen receptor pathway and the alterations thereof. The other one that is emerging is becoming more important is abnormalities in the DNA repair pathway. and also in you know, RB and P53 as in the cell cycle. So I think there are going to be therapies which target all this. There may also be a role for immunotherapy, which could again tie in with DNA disrepair. So in fact, there are two important papers all in the last year. So the first one is looking at defects in DNA repair. So what we know is if you take primary prostate cancer, the incidence is only about 2% or less. But if you look at prostate cancers of men who present with metastatic disease, it's more like about 10 to 11%. And then if you look at tumors where people have been heavily pretreated, it may be more like 22%. So how best do we screen these men? I think that's all under debate, but I think there is consensus that men with metastatic disease or who present with metastatic disease, so it's not somebody who was diagnosed 10 years earlier, now has developed metastasis, but who presents with metastatic disease, they probably should, you know, have their tumor looked at for defects in DNA repair. And then clearly, and these are the main genes that are abnormal, 44% BRCA2, 7% are mutated in BRCA1, and then ATM and CHEK2, and then all these other ones in a much lower percentage. And the other paper that came out was DNA repair defects in, so this really should say in metastatic CRPC, and here it was more like 20 to 22%. But anyway, I think these are two important papers. I have them right at the end. I'll stop there and be happy to take questions. Thank you. Yes, sir.
I heard that surgery with the Da Vinci robot increases the chances of side effects. Would it make sense to increase the number of patients with surgery if the side effects are reduced?
I guess so I think the first decision still is, should the prostate come out or not? You know, whether you want to take the whole thing out or whether you want to do open one or whether you do want to do a robotic one. I mean, that's a separate question. I think most people would do robotic. But just because you have a robot, I don't think it's reason enough for the prostate to come out. The main question still is, should it come out or not? In fact, one of the famous urologists came up with saying, are we curing cancers that don't need to be cured? So I think that question still remains. Yeah.
So you mentioned that the majority of the CRPC patients do not have metastasis, and it takes about on average 2 to 3 years for the CRPC patients to develop metastasis.
Right.
So I have a couple of questions for that.
Yeah. And so I'm not sure the majority is a completely accurate statement. It depends where you are and you know, what your practice pattern is. But I would say a significant number don't have any metastasis.
I guess that's based on the combination of serum PSA with the bone scan, right?
Right.
At the time when the patient experiences rising PSA levels,
right,
then the bone scan is kind of negative.
Right, exactly.
So my question, the first question to you is, so in the field, do those patients really just failed the first line, the localized hormone agonist?
Yeah, so I think it's really more, I think that's going to change. It's more a reflection of the fact that you are treating things so early, so that people fail ADT early. Now all they have is a rising PSA. And now you, so if somebody's never seen an anti-androgen like bifidutamide, do you use that?
No, I guess, yeah, so, okay, so,
right.
So my question is that, is that the CRPC kind of like a generic, some maybe include patients who were treated not, you know, with the first line castration, but may also include patients who were treated with, let's say, bifidutamide or even enzalutamide?
No, not enzalutamide. Because there are only two trials now where it's easy to use, the STRIKE study and the TERRAINE study.
Right.
So I think that may again change things.
Okay, so that flowers, but in the literature,
right,
there are some reports that the glutamine itself actually increases the toxins. Right? There are several papers, including a JVC paper from Chong Chong Chong,
right,
reported several years ago, and that's that's one of the sort of aims or projects that John Gillespie is trying to test.
Right.
So related to that, I think that Shinayan also mentioned that they have some evidence that in the lutamide treatment, the second line
concentration
can actually somehow increase the visceral metastasis on the top of it.
Right.
So is that kind of like a sitting in the field?
I don't think so. Because see, I think if you compare bicalutamide, everybody agrees that when you stop bicalutamide, about 10-20% men get anti-androgen drug, or they get anti-androgen. Bicalutamide is well established, right? I've had patients where you stop the bicalutamide and the liver mets got dead. But with enzalutamide, I think we very much see that again. I mean, could it happen? Sure, but nobody is reported in the minds.
But related to that, I mean, in the medical oncologist
right.
mind, then isn't that true that by now we generally think that enzalutamide, with all this ever increasing more powerful concentration strategy,
right.
you are turning relatively benign adenocarcinoma type of tumors into neuroendocrine type of tumors.
Yeah, that is true.
If that's true, theoretically.
Yeah, that is true. So it definitely changes the phenotype.
Right. So by analogy, right?
Right.
I'm not arguing here for arguing sake, but
right.
But we know that the de novo EPC patients generally have a much worse prognosis.
But yeah, I have personally not seen it. I definitely haven't heard too many people talk about it. So in fact, here is the slide. So right, this is from where the biopsy men with CRPC, I meant to show this. So first of all, what it tells you is it's most of these people have cancer in the bone, so it's they're hard to biopsy, right? So this is 220 patients, all CRPC who were biopsied at 6-7 different centers. 118 of them were from bone, 60 were from lymph nodes, 23 from liver, so that's almost just about 10%. Lung was only 3, adrenals 3, other soft tissue 9, brain 1, and bladder 3. So the majority are really, more than half are bone, okay? And of these 220, only 124 were evaluable. So I don't know how many of these 118 were evaluable.
This is the
stand-up
of cancer?
Yeah, this is the stand-up to cancer. Right? It was between OHSU and it's the West Coast Dream Team, whatever they call them. So they basically, these were the sites of biopsy acquisition, and this is the pattern of distribution, and there were 220 patients. Right? But the impressive thing to me is only 124 were evaluable. So in other words, 96 were inevaluable. And I would bet you the majority of those 96 who were inevaluable were probably from bone. I mean, that's why bone biopsies are such a pain. It's the commonest site.
Are you sure this was from patients or actually there are a lot of the actual number of biopsies?
No, these are from actual biopsies. 220 patients and only 124 were evaluable. So 96 were not evaluable.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. Those were not from 220 patients.
Yeah, yeah.
But there are 220 biopsies, which could have come from fewer patients.
That's true. I think this is 220 patients. I need to go double check. But I think really what you're saying is are these 220 samples or 220 patients, right? That's your question. Right. And so in this heavily pretreated group, 13% were actually neuroendocrine, to speak to your point. Okay? And 26% had this intermediate atypical phenotype, and their prognosis is as bad as the neuroendocrine type. So this is also called aggressive variant prostate cancer, but clearly, molecularly, it's not well defined. Okay? And then 26%, were the standard adenocarcinoma. So clearly, when we treat them, when you heavily pre-treat them, a lot of them change character. So, to go back to your point, I think if you treat people with enzalutamide, and if it's very effective, or any effective AR blocker, you could do one of two things. You could change the phenotype, plus you could change the tropism as well.
Any other questions? Thank you.